So this is joint work with Professor Christian Prasad at the University of Maryland. And the message that I'd like to convey is the role of curves and moving frames for visual coordination problems in three dimensions and the design of interaction laws in three dimensions. Professor Christian Prasad is going to give a companion talk on Friday on the last of these topics, and hopefully I'll cover at least some of the first topics listed there. So the kinds of vehicles we have in mind are vehicles that are moving in three dimensions and with speed constraints. For example, this meter scale Dragoneye UAV has to maintain sufficient airspeed to stay aloft. So even though it can change speed somewhat, it can't, for example, stop and hover. And animals like bats share that same property. So in addition to not being able to stop, having this constraint on speed, there's also a certain amount of smoothness to the trajectories that these vehicles follow. In the case of the UAV, it's because of its limited maneuverability. Of course, gravity and wind may be important effects. But we want to understand and design these trajectories, which involve sensor feedback. And so we're led to abstract away the details of these vehicles into point particle models that move along these trajectories. And then we assume that there's an autopilot on board the vehicle or the animal, which is responsible for tracking those trajectories that are produced by our control laws. So given a trajectory in three space, one way that you can describe it is with a system of ordinary differential equations like this, where S is the arc length parameter, prime denotes differentiation with respect to the arc length parameter, R is a vector denoting the position of a point along the curve, and X is the unit tangent vector to the trajectory at R, Y and Z complete a right-handed orthonormal frame. And this isn't the only way of writing down a system of equations to describe how this curve evolves with respect to arc length parameter, but it's the one that we prefer, and I'll talk more about that later. The planar version of this is much simpler. If you have a planar trajectory, which is represented as a function of arc length parameter, here R denotes position along the trajectory, as now it's a two vector instead of a three vector. X is the unit tangent vector in the plane, Y is the unit normal vector in the plane, and U, the control, has the interpretation simply of a steering control. So going back to the 3D case, U and V here are known as the natural curvatures, and they're analogous to this steering control, and we're thinking of them as the controls by which this curve is swept out. So if we want to now consider a particle moving along this trajectory with some possibly varying speed, but a speed which we assume never vanishes, and therefore also has always the same sign, the speed is the derivative of arc length parameter with respect to time, and using the chain rule, we can write the equations of motion for the particle by using the equations from the curve, and simply we end up with a factor of the speed showing up due to the chain rule. So I'll talk in more detail about this later, but I just wanted to introduce it up front because I wanted to say that for purposes of my talk, we're taking speed identically equal to 1 for all particles. And the reason that we're doing that is because we want to understand the role of curvature control in the design of interaction laws. So the kind of connection to the physical reality of this assumption is that a vehicle like a UAV, we have relatively a lot of actuation ability in the steering directions, much less so in the speed changes. So we'll consider the curvature controls as the controls that we have at our disposal for designing interaction laws, and then the speed of the vehicles may be really more governed by flight conditions, wind conditions, gravity, things that we don't really want to explicitly control, but we want to let the autopilot attempt to overcome. So these are some old simulations now. This was in 2002, but some of you probably haven't seen them, and they reveal what it is that got us actually very interested in these laws in the first place, that From random initial conditions, we can bring together these unit speed particles into something that looks like a formation. And if you watch this closely, the reason it ends up heading off in this particular direction is because there's a straggler that needs to catch up. It can't change its speed, so the whole group has to turn in order to allow the straggler to catch up. And here's another law, which is able to stabilize circling motion. And these are planar simulations, so this is all taking place in the plane. When we saw this in the plane, we asked, could we generalize these kinds of control laws to 3D?
The difference in the parameters of these two simulations.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What is the difference?
Oh, well, it's a different control law. I mean, it's not just that they're, this is using a control law that's specifically designed to stabilize this type of what I call rectilinear formation. This is a different control law to stabilize a circling formation. And I'll show you what those control laws look like. So rather than get distracted by the particular applications that we might have in mind for formations of vehicles, I'm just going to show this slide and say if if these pilots can have this much fun flying in formation, why shouldn't we? So this shows two ways, two alternative methods of framing a curve. The one that I showed on the earlier slide corresponds to this one, but I'm going to start by describing this one because it's probably, possibly more familiar to people. This is the Fournier-Serret frame for a space curve or a curve in three dimensions. And so the regularity we require is that the curve be three times continuously differentiable and the second derivative of the curve never vanish, which physically corresponds to no part of the curve being a perfectly straight line, even at a single point. And in, under those assumptions, there's this uniquely defined Fournier-Serret frame. T is denoting the unit tangent vector to the trajectory, N is the unit normal vector, B is the unit binormal vector. B and N span this normal plane, which is transverse to the vector T. And the system of equations, the Fournier-Serret equations are given here. Derivative of the curve with respect to arc length parameter is given by the unit tangent vector. And then the frame evolves according to the system of equations, where kappa is the curvature, tau is the torsion. Those are what we're thinking of as controls if we're thinking of how this trajectory is being swept out. And the curvature and torsion are invariants of the curve. So the difficulty that we have with this setup is not being able to have perfectly straight flight and still have this frame be uniquely defined. So we found that a better choice is this natural Fournier or relatively parallel adapted frame. And here, the unit tangent vector T is the same as before, but we don't require as much regularity. We only require the curve to be twice continuously differentiable, and we don't have this requirement either. It's perfectly okay to have straight segments. Now, the price we pay is then that there's an overall freedom in how the initial normal vectors are chosen. So we have, because the tangent vector is still uniquely defined, there's a uniquely defined tangent plane, but the choice of orientation of the normal vectors m1 and m2 in this plane is something that we're free to choose. So there's a rotational degree of freedom here at the initial time. Once you nail it down at the initial time, then these equations give you a unique solution for future time, which corresponds to parallel translation of these normal vectors. Or in other words, these equations work to try to keep M1 as parallel as possible to itself as the curve evolves, and M2 as parallel as possible to itself. Of course, it can't do a perfect job because this is a curve with a true three-dimensional character. So these are the equations for the relatively parallel adapted frame, and instead of curvature and torsion, we have this K1 and K2 as controls, and these are the natural curvatures.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So, I mean, but the way that you could make them perfectly parallel, I think, is by making it a straight line. So your objective is to do what you said you didn't want to do.
Right, well, so I'm explaining why we use this particular framing of the curve, because if we use this choice of equations to describe our trajectories, we don't have any problem with describing straight, perfectly straight trajectories. It simply corresponds to the K1 and K2 being zero, and that's not a problem in this setup. But it is a problem for Bernays Array. Yeah?
So in directly linear motion, will the frame will have a problem? You said that we...
Well, what happens is if you have rectilinear, perfectly rectilinear motion, the Fresnel array frame isn't uniquely defined. And yeah. Now, there is a close relationship between these two descriptions of the curve evolution and also a whole family of additional possibilities that I haven't even mentioned. But they share, in some sense, a similar structure. If you package these variables into this left invariant system, which if you don't want to think this mathematically, you can just think about this as just a repackaging into a matrix differential equation of the system, then here the G is a rotation matrix, which just is either the frame vectors TNB or the frame vectors TM1, M2, depending on whether it's Fresnel array or natural frame. And then gamma is simply the curve variable. And this skew symmetric matrix here either has this form for the Fresnel array case, where kappa is the curvature and tau is the torsion, or this form, where K1 and K2 are the natural curvatures. So right away you see that this left invariant system on SE3, where SE3 is just the special Euclidean group in three dimensions, or the group of rigid motions in three dimensions, we can already see evidence that this is going to play an important role. But in this talk, I'm going to try to downplay that so that even the non-mathematically oriented audience can follow what's going on. So here, these are the equations for the curvature and torsion for the Fresnel array case. You can see they're given by just formulas involving derivatives of the curve. In the case of the natural curvatures, they depend on derivatives of the curve, but also on the initial choice of normal vector orientation, as you would expect. So the natural curvatures for a given curve aren't unique, but once you make this choice of initial normal vectors, then they're unique after that point. And there's a close relationship between kappa and tau and the natural curvatures K1 and K2. In particular, when they're both well-defined, the Fresnel array curvature is kind of the norm of the natural curvature vector. Now, the natural Fresnel frame also gives a convenient way to understand certain special curves by looking at the normal development plane. So the normal development plane is a plot of K2 versus K1, and so if you have a curve, you plot all the points K1 versus K2 on the K1-K2 plane, and then based on what locus of points you get, you may be able to infer something about the trajectory. So if the plot is just simply a single point, then that means that corresponds to a trajectory, which is simply a circle. If the K1 and K2 lie on a line passing through the origin, then the trajectory is actually planar in some plane. If K1 and K2 are going around in a circle at constant speed, then the corresponding trajectory is a right circular helix in three dimensions. And most interestingly, if this locus of points lies on a line not passing through the origin, that actually tells you that the trajectory lies on the surface of a sphere. And characterizing something like this, for example, with Fresnel array framework is rather ugly. So now we're going to go back to the notation that I showed.
But what is it? Is it like a great circle on a sphere? Or?
No, just... And if you have an arbitrary trajectory that moves around on the surface of a sphere, so it could look pretty crazy. It doesn't have to be a great circle. It could be just an arbitrary trajectory, but it doesn't leave the surface of the sphere. Then when you plot the locus of points K1 versus K2 in that K1, K2 plane, you'll find that they lie on a line, not passing through the origin.
Is that different?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, it's not, it's by no means obvious. I mean, you have to do some calculation and convince yourself it's the case. It's one of these sort of nice properties. A little bit of magic you get also, you know, for free by using the natural Fernaferrin rather than Fernaferrin. So now we're going to treat these two interacting particles using this unit speed model based on natural Fernet frames. So as before, for particle one, its position as a function of time is given by R1, and if the unit tangent vector to its trajectory is x1, y1 and z1 lie in the plane normal to x1, and this is a right-handed orthonormal frame for particle one. U1 and V1 are the controls for particle 1, and similarly for particle 2. And because we have two particles, we can also define the relative position vector R, which takes you from R1 to R2. So these natural curvatures, U1, V1, U2, V2, are what we're thinking of as controls, and we'd like to find forms for these controls which give rise to formations. The specific types of two-vehicle formations that we focus in on, because they're the ones that we can actually prove global stability of our control laws, are these rectilinear formations where the two particles end up moving side by side, separated by some nominal spacing, a collinear formation, which I won't talk about much, and a circling formation where the two particles follow the same circular orbit separated by a diameter. So here for two particles are two different cases. In this case, a control law is being used which stabilizes a rectilinear law. In this case, a circling law. These are actually fully three-dimensional simulations, but you're looking down onto the plane in which the final formation lies. So just looking at this, it's kind of the you don't really see the 3D behavior. But what I want to focus on here is we have this Lyapunov function, in this case, a different Lyapunov function here, but I'm going to focus on this case because it's a little simpler. And it's this Lyapunov function which is what enables us to prove convergence for arbitrary initial conditions to this final steady state formation. And the Lyapunov function consists of two terms. One is a term that's a relative heading dependent term. So here, x1 dot x2 is the heading, your unit tangent vector for vehicle 1 dotted with the heading for vehicle 2, or in other words, it's just the cosine of the angle between those two directions. And so this term is minimized when this dot product is 1, or in other words, when both vehicles are heading in exactly the same direction. This other term is a relative distance term, and the form of h is shown here. So h has a single minimum at nominal separation r naught. If the particles are too close together, or the particles get closer together, h goes off to infinity. If the particles get further apart, h also goes off to infinity. Yes?
To what extent are these patterns parameterized at the outset? In other words, are they not? For example, other than saying a circle, what is it about a circle that you specify or not?
Well, in the rectilinear case, things are simple because it's just this R naught parameter that gives you the final nominal separation. And
what about the
in the circling case,
what about the heading, for example?
I'm sorry.
What about the heading in the rectilinear case?
Oh, well, that's initial condition dependent. I haven't said it yet, but we're for these two particle interactions, we're considering control laws which are invariant under rigid motions, or in other words, they only depend on relative quantities, relative distances, relative headings. So as a result, the final direction in which the formation heads just depends on the initial conditions.
Is that true of all laws? That they're invariant under
fundamental. Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I'll say more about that later. Okay, so
I'm sorry. I was just curious. You didn't end up explaining the radius of the circle.
Oh, This one is, it's a little more complicated. It's the radius of the circle depends on the R naught in this function h, but that's not the only thing it depends on. And that's one reason why the analysis of the circling law is a little more complicated and why I'm going to just focus on the rectilinear law.
Well, with the rectilinear law alone, don't you have a bunch of problems if you have, I mean, if you have many of them together, you're not going to have the same amount
of well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now I'm only talking about the two particle interactions. When you, because this is what we have the convergence results for that are global. And as you add more particles, you see phenomena like in the earlier talks where it's catastrophic.
Yes, catastrophic.
catastrophic in a good way. So, so the models that we have because of this unit speed assumption initially turn out to be models of gyroscopically interacting particles. So I just want to say a word about that. So V on the previous slide, either the rectilinear or circling version, is not to be thought of as a synthetic potential. It's really a Lyapunov function for the shape dynamics. So this is getting back to Steve's question. We have the dynamics for the particles where we're trying to achieve this formation. When we look at the shape quantities, which are the relative quantities, we'd like to see those converging to an actual equilibrium. And so it's those dynamics that V is representing a Lyapunov function for. And the kinetic energy of each particle is conserved because of this interaction by gyroscopic forces, and also because of the initial conditions, then they all move at unit speed with the way we set up the equation. So to picture what a gyroscopic force is, it means that these particles, which are have assumed unit mass, the F equals ma that gives rise to their motion along these trajectories, are determined by forces which lie in this normal plane. So the force could be potentially any vector in this normal plane, but it's restricted to the normal plane. There's no component of the force along the x direction. In the plane, things are somewhat simpler because the force has to act along one specific direction, which is the normal direction, or the y direction. There's an analogy with the Lorentz force law for charged particles in magnetic field, but it's not a very, but I'm not going to follow that further. And also in mechanics, gyroscopic forces are associated with vector potentials, not scalar potentials. And these are basic references on gyroscopic systems. So the procedure, this is starting to get into the procedure we use to find these three-dimensional laws, is we start with the Lyapunov function, and this is the rectilinear one I showed earlier. We differentiate it along trajectories of the system. So we differentiate the first term here with respect to time, and we get this. Differentiate the second term, and we get this, where F, let's see, I put it on there, but it's here. F is this dotted line here. And it's simply the derivative of this function h with respect to its argument. And it has a zero crossing at r naught. It's positive to the right, it's negative to the left. So that's the function that's showing up here. Then if we plug in for x1 dot and x2 dot the dynamical equations, then we get this expression for V dot. And then we'd like to find controls U2, V2, V1, which have two parts. One part cancels off this term, and the other part, which is where these capital F functions are showing up, have to be chosen in such a way that this whole expression can be shown that it's less than or equal to zero. And if we're able to do that, then we can use Lassalle's invariance principle to prove convergence of the system to the largest invariance set of the set on which V dot equals zero, which almost gives us what we want, but a further linear analysis can be used to assess stability of particular equilibrium within that set. So the problem, going back here, the difficulty is just looking at this expression for V dot, it's not exactly jumping right out at you how to choose these controls to achieve this objective, and also to satisfy certain symmetry constraints.
Y and Z are?
Y and Z are the normal vectors associated with the natural Fernand frame. So let's see. So going back to here,
okay.
Yeah, it's important to, it's difficult but important to keep things straight. So to go about this systematically, what we do is we first restrict to the planar setting, and in this case, the form of the Lyapunov function is the same as in 3D, except that now these are interpreted as two-dimensional vectors instead of three-dimensional vectors. And then our natural Fernet frame equations simplify quite a bit because we only have controls U1 and U2. We don't have the Vs. And also the V dot expression simplifies also because, again, we only have a couple of terms in just involving the two controls. So we have a chance then of being able to actually find satisfactory controls for this planar problem, and then once we do, we can return to the 3D setting and look at how can we generalize this planar law so that the calculations go through in the right way for the 3D setting, and then finally we interpret the resulting 3D control law to try to understand why it takes the form that we derived. But we're not trying to visualize a priori what form it should have. We're using this systematic approach to hopefully have it find it with a minimal effort. So here's the form of the planar law that we found, and this goes also back to 2002. So the steering control for vehicle 1, U1, is this function capital F of its arguments minus a term involving little f, the derivative of the function h in the Lyapunov function. And U2 has a similar form, but there are some sign changes due to symmetry, and there's some swapping of arguments, again, because of some symmetry considerations. And the specific form of capital F that we use is shown here. And you can interpret this law in a biologically appealing way. If you look at what these terms really are, they're just dot products of various unit vectors. So they're essentially sines and cosines of various angles between things like the vector R, the baseline vector between the vehicles, and the heading of vehicle 2. This one's the heading of vehicle 1, normal vector for vehicle 2, and so on. So these terms are actually fairly simple, even though the first glance at this equation you might be scared away. So the first term can be interpreted as serving to align each vehicle perpendicular to the baseline between the vehicles, but without caring whether they're both heading in the same direction or the opposite direction. The second term is serving to align the vehicle with the heading of the other vehicle. So this is definitely the heading alignment term. And this term is the term that controls the steering toward or away from the other particle in order to maintain the prescribed separation. So we've seen this kind of behavior in other models talked about in this conference and also in the past literature. So it turns out that a very similar form for the control law also works in 3D. All we do is add some symmetry constraints and use basically the form we've got for U2 in the planar setting, and we wind up with a uniquely defined control law for 3D that also satisfies the conditions that we needed for V dot. So the symmetry considerations, one is that the control law only depend on shape quantities. This is the rigid motion symmetry of the system that I mentioned earlier. Also, the effect of the control should only depend on the sort of physically meaningful variables, which is the relative distance, the heading of vehicle 1, the heading of vehicle 2. In other words, if you choice of normal vectors should not have an effect on the trajectories of the particles in the system. That should be washed out by symmetry. And we also have this symmetry, this discrete symmetry, that both vehicles run the same algorithm. So even though I've labeled them vehicle one and vehicle two, they don't even need to know whether which one is vehicle one and which is vehicle two, because they're running the same steering law. So again, this is the form of the function capital F. We can identify the baseline alignment term, the heading alignment term. This term is somewhat different for the rectilinear versus the circling law. And I've just repeated the frame evolution equations here. There's also a condition on the parameters that the heading alignment be in some sense strong enough relative to the baseline alignment to ensure that in the rectilinear case that they actually both converge to the same direction instead of to opposite directions. So writing it all out, this is, in all its glory, this is the control law for the three-dimensional rectilinear formation of two particles. Here's the natural curvature controls for vehicle one, natural curvature controls for vehicle two. Yeah?
Can vehicles swap position as long as they maintain separation?
They're
maintaining it laterally and longitudinally instead of laterally.
Well, I think that the answer I would give is that the trajectories can cross as long as the particles don't collide. But of course, the exact trajectories are going to be initial condition dependent. I presume one could find initial conditions where the trajectories would cross for two particles. Certainly, in the plane, when you have multiple particles, there's lots of crossings of the trajectories, and you can still plot the interparticle distances and observe that the separation is maintained. Yeah.
We must have a lot of trouble going from two to three particles. Why is that? Do you have a reason?
The trouble is the theoretical difficulty proving the global convergence result. I should say that in simulation, it's very compelling that it appears that there may be some kind of a convergent behavior. It's just the theoretical difficulty. And I think that it probably has to do with some symmetry considerations that that there's something special about two particles that when you go to three, you have cases like all three particles heading in exactly 120 degree apart directions that that can lead to problems in trying to show that V dot is less than or equal to zero if you try to use a kind of an analogous Lyapunov function. So it's these. So what you can actually do for more than two particles is you can still prove nonlinear but non-global results as long as you're sort of start close enough to the right equilibrium formation. Then you can show that there's sort of some region of attraction. The problem with trying to get a global result are sort of these bad configurations, like I just mentioned, where there are three vehicles heading 120 with 120 degree different headings that make it hard to get the balance.
Does it have to be using relative distance, relative stuff? Mm-hmm. So that means that you really, in a sense, are dropping a dimension. Is that so? The two particles is really sort of a very crude, sort of a one dimensional problem. Is that part of the reason, or do you understand what I'm saying?
I guess the message is lower dimension is always easier.
One dimension is very special. That's the question.
I guess I would say I can either confirm or deny that. Two particles is special. But I'll say something about the n particle case. This is what the form of the control law looks like in all its glory. And now we want to interpret what this actually means. So we notice that we can express the control law for one of the particles, say particle 2, as by defining this vector A, and then the steering control, or curvature control U2 is this vector A dotted with the corresponding unit normal vector, and similarly for V2. So what this means is that this vector A is some vector in an arbitrary direction, but what's providing the force on this particle to give the control is the projection of this vector A onto the normal plane. So this gives you an avenue to interpret what the form of the control law means physically. So for example, if we only had this term, what this would mean is the heading of the other particle is projected onto the normal plane to provide the force that the second particle feels, which you can see is going to tend to try to align the heading of the second particle with this x1. But of course, we also have in our law these terms which involve the baseline vector. And of course, similarly for the other particle. So here's the, hopefully to address the problem of generalization to n vehicles. So these are three-dimensional simulations of 10, I think, particles using a particular generalization of the two-particle interaction law. So what this looks like is the natural curvature controls are an average of the pairwise interactions that we had in the two-particle case. And of course, there's one copy of the natural Fournier frame equations corresponding to each particle. So for the rectilinear law, you can do this until you get exhausted. And you always see from arbitrary initial conditions this behavior of the particles coming together, heading off in a certain direction. And similarly for the circling law, you see them come and wind up on a circle. Of course, the plane in which the circle lies is initial condition dependent. And for the particular law that I showed previously, there's no particular tendency for these particles to exactly equally space themselves along the circular trajectory. So based on these simulations, we conjecture that there's some kind of convergence result here. But because of the difficulties I mentioned in answer to Steve's question, we think that what's really happening is we're led to consider a new class of n-body problems. That the problem, we don't know, or we're not confident that this is exactly the right interaction law to use to get good results. So we think we're heading along promising direction that would maybe allow some theoretical results for more than two vehicles, but it with just this form of interaction law, it looks like it's been a difficult problem to prove that. So still, though, I would say that for some of the statistical physics interacting particle models, there's also no proof of convergence necessarily either. So at least we're starting from a two-particle system where we hope we can maybe build in some rational way. So one thing that we can do, or results we can show for n particles, are characterizing equilibrium formation. So under the assumption that the control laws are invariant under rigid motions, then the shape equilibria correspond to steady state formations in three dimensions. There's only three possibilities: rectilinear formations where all the particles head in the same direction, circling formations where the particles circle on circular orbits with a common axis, and helical formations where the particles all move in the same direction along helical orbits with the same axis and pitch. And these are the only possibilities because of the unit speed constraint.
Why do you have two orbits?
You could have any number. I mean, there's no requirement that the particles lie on the same helical trajectory. They could lie on helices that are translated up and down along the axis. What it just means is if you are riding along on one of these particles, the whole formation appears static. So that's what it means to be at a shape equilibrium formation. So this we're able to prove, and the Lie group setting that I mentioned earlier is sort of key to proving results like that. So certainly the SE3 notation or the packaging of these frame equations into these matrices and then doing manipulations with these matrices is the right thing to do in some sense. So here you get explicitly, you can explicitly write down what the shape variables are. So I've been talking about shape variables as in kind of a vague sense as being relative directions, relative distances. Here, this is really the concrete formula that defines shape variables. So in the two-particle case, here, G1 is the matrix in SE3 corresponding to particle 1, similarly for G2. And the shape variable is G1 inverse G2. What's nice about this is if you have n particles, you define G1 up to Gn the same way, and the shape variables are just the Gj inverse Gk. And we get the dynamics then as being left invariant systems on SE3, but I don't need to discuss that too much. The one other thing I want to say is when you use these shape variables, the equations, both the control for the controls and the Lyapunov function, take nice simple forms. So here, the G, I, J are the elements of the matrix G. G superscript I, J are elements of G inverse. And here you can really see the symmetry, the relabeling symmetry in the control laws, because there's no sign changes, that no arbitrary looking sign changes when you express the equations in the group variables this way. You can really see that they're the same. So another problem that we can attack using these pair of interacting particle ideas, obstacle avoidance or boundary following, and this is joint work with Fu Min, who's here. And so the setup is you have a unit speed particle which is moving, but it's responding to the closest point on the boundary of a fixed obstacle. So the obstacle is fixed, but the closest point to the moving vehicle moves along the obstacle boundary, although not at unit speed. And there's a planar version of this, and there's also a three-dimensional generalization of this problem. So using the same kind of approach, we can write down a Lyapunov function for boundary following, which is very similar, but not quite identical to the Lyapunov function we had for the rectilinear motion. So there's a term here that's favoring motion parallel to the boundary curve, and then another term that's the same form as the term before that penalizes distances from the boundary curve which are too large or too small. And then we can derive a planar law and give a physical interpretation, a term which aligns, a steering term which aligns parallel to the boundary curve, another term which is the separation maintaining and collision avoidance term, and then there's an additional term that responds to the non-zero curvature of the boundary curve.
So, does the shape of the boundary matter? Like whether it's going to be a convex?
Well, if it makes you happy, we'll assume for purposes of this talk that it's a convex obstacle, but we can actually handle some concavity, but it's limited.
The distance function has to be well-defined,
right? Right. Yeah, so if you have a single convex obstacle, you don't have a problem. If you have multiple obstacles, then, yeah, you have a deeper problem. So we can think of this as kind of a local law for boundary tracking, if you like. The sort of global path planning problem is not addressed here. And using the same kind of technique of differentiating the Lyapunov function, seeing what the analogous calculation is in 3D as gave us favorable results in 2D, we can derive a 3D version of the law for boundary tracking. And this could, for example, be used if you had a UAV that you were trying to guide over hilly terrain and you wanted to kind of hug the terrain for some reason.
Is excuse me, where do I see the obstacle represented in the equation?
Yeah, which one's x? I mean, what's x1 and x2 at the top?
Sorry. So here, particle 2 is the one that's moving. Particle 1 is the one that's restricted to line of boundary. So in these equations, U2 is the steering control for the vehicle that's moving. The quantities that are subscript 1 are the ones that are associated with the particle on the boundary. And U1 and V1 are the measured natural curvatures of the virtual point moving along the boundary. So they can be calculated if you know the boundary or measure the boundary using some laser rangefinder, for example, to get an approximation. So here's a movie just showing the interaction of a moving particle and the virtual particle combined to a spherical boundary. And you'll see that it comes into formation with the virtual particle and then ends up, in this case, just circling on a great circle because of the symmetry of this spherical obstacle. So I guess that's enough of that one. So, of course, we would like to ultimately work toward combining these behaviors. So to have multiple interacting particles, multiple obstacles, and here there's this X with a circle around it is kind of a beacon that we want all the vehicles to try to get to. So you can see that they're just using these kind of averaged interaction laws. It's also using the circling law once it gets close enough to the beacon, and it's kind of has a graded transition between the rectilinear and circling as it gets closer to the beacon that it wants to circle. But you can get these, of course, fairly complicated looking behaviors here, the beacon jump to another point, just based on these simple interaction laws of the vehicles trying to, or particles trying to avoid the obstacles and trying to get into these formations as best they can. As far as the matter, again, to get back to sort of proving results for the multi-particle case, we'd like to prove whatever we can, but I think that given the complexity of a scenario like this and also the additional constraints that we have, that we want to also do this in a way that if you look at the trajectories followed by the vehicles, there's not too much steering, because steering is something we consider to be energetically expensive in terms of vehicle propulsion. So you throw in all of these constraints and it's not clear that you're ever going to be happy with results you can prove in this totally more complicated setting. Yeah.
What are the information available to each particular?
Oh, in this case, everyone has total knowledge, all-to-all coupling. We're considering here modest numbers of particles. The scalability issue would have to be addressed either through kind of the n-body formulation where you try to approximate some groups of vehicles by a smaller number of parameters or some continuum modeling. But right now, the stage that we're at is we're just considering small enough numbers of particles that the total information is an acceptable hypothesis. Yeah.
Complexity you're undertaking. I'm just wondering, as far as simulation goes, have you attempted any simulations where the neighbors change?
No. I should say that this is kind of the neighborhood here is sort of the whole situation. So I mean, everyone is everyone else's neighbor. Everyone knows what everyone else is doing. I think that you could consider these sort of pairwise interactions as things that you could use as building blocks for a system where you didn't have necessarily all-to-all communication, but vehicles only interact with their neighbors but still execute these kind of similar lower-level behaviors to avoid colliding with their neighbors. Because, for example, collision avoidance, you really only probably care about not colliding with the neighbors who are close to you. So in some ways, maybe it's a little silly to have collision avoidance terms for neighbors that are very far away. But these are sort of just details from our review. So we have testbed effort also associated with this project, because we'd like to fly these control laws on actual UAVs, and one reason to use these nice kind of simple control laws is because there is limited processing capability and communication capability on board these vehicles. So this DragonEye vehicle is a kind of a hand-launched, sort of catapult-launched vehicle that the Marine Corps is currently using just as a single, one vehicle at a time for surveillance missions. And instead of landing, it just crashes into the ground and breaks apart to absorb the impact. So what we've done to try to simulate multiple ones of these, because they're still $20,000 each, and even though they can take a fair amount of abuse, there's a limit to how many we could, you know, crash. So instead, we're simulating this by autopilot hardware-in-the-loop simulation. And I, for those of you who saw the poster session the other day, I had the poster on this. We have, in this case, three autopilots which are communicating with the ground station. And associated with each autopilot is a computer that runs the flight dynamic simulation using the models and parameters for the actual DragonEye vehicle. And then there's a second computer which associated with each autopilot which just communicates with the autopilot and exchanges the telemetry data with it from the simulation. And then the ground station collects all this data, computes the controls, sends them back, and then I have a movie also showing how this works, which maybe I'll just start at the end during the question period. Of course, we'd like to put a wireless network for UAV to UAV communication and have embedded controllers in the vehicles, but we're still a ways away from that. So it's, I would say, certainly not beyond the realm of possibility that we could accomplish in this limited way what the formation flyers have fun with on the earlier slide. So just to kind of connect back to physical reality, what it is we're mainly concerned about with these UAV problems, and I mention this because I think it's there should be similar kind of considerations for animals as well, that you want to faithfully follow some trajectories, in this case waypoint specified trajectories, and you want to maintain sufficient separation between vehicles to avoid collisions, but also very significantly a thing that we want to do is minimize steering, because for UAVs or other air vehicles, turning requires considerably more energy than straight level flight. Vehicles like DragonEye, for example, they're really most efficient if they can just fly straight and level. As soon as they bank to turn, their side slip, they have to add a lot of propulsion to overcome that. So in addition to having reasonably well-performing control laws for rectilinear and circling motion, it's also important to study the transitions between circling and then coming back from coming back to rectilinear and then going from rectilinear transitioning to circling. So in practice, there's a lot of additional things to do besides simply studying these little two-particle models. Sorry, go ahead. Did you have a question? Another thing that I'll mention is that an advantage, you may say, well, these natural Fernet frame equations, these look like they would be terrible to try to simulate. Things are so complicated. But actually, there's these are nice equations to simulate if you discretize them in the right way. So what we've done, and this applies to all the simulations that I've shown so far in this talk, is we use piecewise constant controls. So we compute what the values of the controls would be from our interaction laws at the beginning of a time interval, T sub m, which is just m times capital T for some capital T, and then m equal 1, 2, etc. And we use that value of the control as the control that's applied over the time interval T sub m to T sub m plus 1. And then as a result of that, on that interval where we have constant control, we can solve, and I've shown you the planar system, we can solve these equations exactly just by integration, and this is what we get for solution for x and y the next time step. This is what we get for r, the position of the particle, and then we can do a little bit of further simplification and get down to a system of equations that lets us compute the position and orientation of the particle at the next time step in a very efficient way. And this property also, it turns out, carries over to the 3D system as well. So even in in 3D, if you have piecewise constant controls, then it, the trajectory is during that piecewise, during that segment from time tn to time tn plus 1, the trajectory lies in a plane, in some plane, and you can calculate what that plane is and then use the formulas on the previous slide to update the frame and position at the end of the that time step. So we're really in good shape for even doing simulations in 3D. It's not in any way computationally prohibitive. So that's all I'll say about that. And here's the list of references, and you can find the papers on this website. And so since we just have the 2 minutes left, while people are asking questions, we can I'll show the movie of the multi. So in this demo, it's three UAVs, one of which is just following a prescribed trajectory. So it's sort of a leader-follower, where two vehicles are following a leader. I think this one might be the leader, I'm not sure. Well, one of the three is the leader. And here in this view, you're looking straight at one of the UAVs, so you see another UAV crossing its trajectory in the background. This is imagery from of Washington, D.C., and this is being visualized using a program called SimDIS, which has been developed at NRL to do real-time visualization of moving vehicles and with respect to background imagery. So this is our experimental demo. The jumps you see are just moving the camera, basically the virtual camera, so you can see the formation evolving. So I guess I'll stop there and take any more questions.
Are they trying to go in a straight line?
I'm sorry?
What are they trying to do?
They're just trying to come into a formation and just fly in some direction. Just do a flyover of restricted airspace.
In parallel.
Yeah, this is the reclamation. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was wondering about the constraints that you put on the problem. So one was the waypoint, the inter-vehicle distance, and the third was some penalty on the distance. So is this something that comes from the user community, or is it something that you need to be appropriate to tell them about? So there were three things that you were looking at in this paper. So one was the having to fly through designated waypoints, maintain some separate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, oh.
And then the third thing you imposed was the steering.
Right. Right. That came from interactions with the group at Naval Research Lab, which does the UAVs and had some potential applications, but also these are parts. And I should mention also that this hardware in the loop demo is a collaborative effort with NRL, and the autopilots were provided by NRL, and they also provided the hardware to do the simulation. We provided the control laws and some assistance in getting their demo up and running, addressing the theoretical issues. So I don't want to portray this as being in any way only our work, but very much joint work with NRL.
How would the Frenet type of approach work if the obstacle is just randomly appearing and disappearing?
That's I would say more a question of what the vehicle capabilities are. So one problem with these UAVs is that they are, relatively speaking, not very maneuverable because of the high speeds they move at and their limited steering ability. So in the past, it's been attempted to put sensors on the small vehicles to try to detect obstacles that appear as the UAV comes upon them, and it usually fails catastrophically in the bad sense of catastrophic, because the vehicle, by the time it sees an obstacle, it doesn't have the ability to maneuver out of the way anymore. So
you just take it out as a simulation because it crashes anyway?
Well, in this case, there's no obstacles in this simulation here. But in reality, to do the obstacle avoidance or boundary following with UAVs, you have to expect to do something more sophisticated than just respond to obstacles that you see on your own sensors. You have to somehow expect to either pre-program information about an obstacle map into the vehicle so that it knows beforehand where the obstacles are, or at least if you detect obstacles, for example, one UAV may have a sensor to detect obstacles, but it may not be able to avoid the obstacle. Maybe it can still communicate the information about the existence of that obstacle to the UAVs behind it so they know in time and can take into account. Kind of the simple control laws that are doing the obstacle avoidance have the advantage that you don't have to, I mean, you can change the obstacle environment and keep running the control law, the same law, and attempt to avoid the obstacles. It's not a situation where you have to kind of completely pre-plan everything in advance to use the system. It is a kind of a real-time computation of the steering controls that you need to avoid obstacles. So if you put new obstacles in that you're able to avoid, then the approach should work for that.
So you wouldn't switch to like a random type of approach or something like that into the equations? I mean, your controllers, they're all like deterministic. You know what I mean?
Everything's deterministic?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I didn't mention it, but we do, in the simulations that I showed, we do insert a little bit of noise to, because you want to make sure you're seeing generic behavior, that you haven't chosen some particularly peculiar initial condition. And we feel that in a system, in the real system, if you actually have measurements of position and orientation, you're going to have noise in the system. Enough noise to sort of do symmetry breaking if you don't know whether to go left or right with an obstacle, for example.
Any other questions? All right, let's take the speaker.